Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is September 12th, 2002. Today's session is Nikes and French Fries and Jeans, Oh My, a forum on globalization presented by Michael Schutt. Let's listen in.
Now, or as we leave tonight for Vesper Resurgence, and we work to help connect individuals and congregations, help connect their Christian faith with caring for creation and justice for all creation. And we do that through programs that help reclaim a theology of care for all creation, a worldview of care for all creation from both the Christian scriptures and also the various elements of the tradition. And then also to ask, so what would that mean for everyday life? So we have a book called Simpler Living, Compassionate Life that talks about everyday lifestyle choices and their impacts on the rest of the earth, and how might we change some of those habits to reflect greater care for all that is. We bring church groups out on habitat restoration projects, like the salmon habitat restoration project, or get folks involved in supporting community-supported agriculture, so connecting food choices with faith. So if you want to know more about us, feel free to check out our stuff on the table and get on our mailing list if you'd like to, then we'll send you a little packet of information and an invitation to join us if you would end up choosing to do so. Well, I have bitten off more than I can chew in this topic, as I suppose anyone would and claim to talk about globalization in an hour. To top that off, I'm not an economist, but I don't think we can leave economics to only economists. I think some of the issues that get some of the problems we're facing, such as greed, are more often the purview of pastors and monks and saints, that we need the voice of the church. We need theology to reflect on our own economy. And so when I'm throwing out the word globalization here, there are different kinds of globalization. Specifically tonight, I want to reflect with you about, you know, economic globalization as it's perhaps most reflected in the WTO, the World Trade Organization, is sort of the pinnacle of that, of the structure of economic globalization today. Some of the people marching in the streets in Seattle in 1999 to protest the WTO meetings there were labeled anti-globalization activists. And in some ways that's been an unfortunate occurrence, as certainly some of the elements of globalization most people would embrace. So there are certainly pros and cons to increasing globalization. But with the assumptions that I've written up here on the board, I want to help us look at it critically. The earth is God's, and is therefore it is wrong to degrade the earth, and that we are indeed part of that earth. And that consumption of goods and services, the consumption of those things, is less important than our relationships with one another and our communities. Therefore, we need to find ways to meet our needs without further degrading community, and in parentheses I put human and non-human, because often when we heard the word community, we think human, I think. So we need to find ways of meeting our needs without further degrading community, human and non-human. And also, I think it's important to talk about, because there's almost an acceptance of Tina, as Margaret Thatcher supposedly coined the phrase, Tina, there is no alternative. Tina, there is no alternative. So there's no other alternative than to become more and more of a globalized economy. And that's inevitable and so on. But I think if we have a bit of a historical framework for thinking about that statement, we might see that there are choices made along the ways, and there are other roads we might be able to take that show us there are alternatives. And some of those alternatives may I think will end up valuing these assumptions more closely. Are there any questions or comments so far? Feel free to raise your hand at any time as well. This is meant to be an interactive time. Most Holden classes are, obviously, and this is also a forum in a way. It's a time for you. Many of you will know things that I won't know, and would help to offer them to the class, to the group here. So, with that said, is there anything at this point you'd like to throw out there? What I hope to do is give a little bit of historical background, a couple frameworks for viewing our economic system, and then kind of open it up for discussion and for brainstorming possible alternatives and so on. So I'll start on that, and you can interrupt me when you want. But first of all, what would you say are some of the pros of, in your understanding of the current economic system? Just so I don't want to sort of, you know, dismiss this as a fully unfortunate direction without talking about some of the things that it's been good for.
Well, it provides jobs for people.
Okay, so certainly there have been jobs and economic wealth created for, particularly for people in first world nations, and for some in other countries as well.
Yes, in some of the countries they are doing better working with global companies than they were in the financially anyway than they were in their old systems.
Okay, right. Back here, Peta?
More independence and maybe more independence for women especially.
Okay, so in some cultures, women have had more economic opportunities and maybe an independence. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Others?
So there's a greater variety of goods and services.
There's more stuff out there. Which, what's that?
I said we get bananas.
We get bananas. Now, might there be downsides to getting bananas?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's an advantage, perhaps, to some of us who all love bananas. Apparently, bananas are, the way they are grown and the way the growers are treated, are one of the most damaging food choices we can make, apparently, from what I've read about bananas. But so there are more goods and services available to some.
Is comparative advantage in free markets a thing that you're embracing in this or not?
That I'm embracing?
Yeah.
Well, that's certainly a characteristic of...
Give me a comment on bananas and third world countries are not necessarily free markets. Some are not. But comparative advantage is the foundation of this country's economic system.
And are you suggesting that that's a pro of the current system, right?
Well,
that it offers certain efficiency.
It's a fact.
Yeah.
It's a fact.
What is
comparative? I mean, there's some negatives and pluses for comparative advantage, but it's a well-known economic theory.
You want to explain comparative advantage for those who may not?
Well, we can take it in... there's a couple different ways you can explain it with people's traits, like the one that I remember mostly from economics was the lawyer. This was before we had PCs, but there was a lawyer that could type 380 words a minute, which was far exceeding any other typist's. He had a real comparative advantage in doing that, but it didn't make sense for him to do that because he was a much more productive person in the law field than he was in typing papers. to translate it into economics for goods and services, like your banana example. I don't know what the downsides of growing bananas are, but I know we can't grow them here.
Right, so if Honduras can grow them really efficiently,
someplace
and we can grow wheat really efficiently.
So that's comparative advantage. You know, like the comparative advantage in the steel industry now is apparently in Japan and other countries that can ship, produce steel cheaper than we can. They have a comparative advantage in that, and if you're going to follow that economic theory, then you should allow them to sell us steel without putting tariffs on, which is what we're doing right now.
Right. So comparative advantage is certainly a reality of the current system. It has its advantages in terms of efficiency. Let me throw out one more positive, at least. How about getting to know other cultures? The breakdown of John Cobb talks about nationalism as one of our idolatries, the idolatry of a nation state, and that one of the things that breaks that down is beginning to get to know other people, learn about other cultures, accept other viewpoints, and so on. But that might actually be enhanced by economic globalization as well, so as something to be celebrated. And there's a hand back here.
Yeah, I wanted to continue the discussion on comparative advantage.
Well, so do you want to switch to talking about some of the cons? Is that where you're going with that?
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about the cons of globalization, economic globalization.
Okay. I'm not counting the idea that the comparative advantage is an efficiency.
Right.
But it also applies to other things other than agriculture, and the banana connection isn't just about temperate zones. It's about laws and the way people are treated. Third world nations don't have the same freedoms and as great quality of life as we enjoy. They don't have this democratic government. And that offers businesses in those countries a comparative advantage, because these third world nations with these more inhumane laws, these lower wages, tax holidays to give away, lower environmental regulations, all these things that go against care for creation and love of justice, are comparative advantages that are being exploited in the current system. These legal deregulations are being used as a comparative advantage to lessen the quality of life of many people.
Okay.
And I mean, that's just a fact of life in a free market system, is that countries now being forced to compete to attract businesses, to attract even sweatshop labor, because at least they're jobs and they need the jobs. But when we have to compete when Thailand has to compete with China over who can make Nike shoes for less and less, you know, the person that loses is the worker. The person that loses is the kid in the assembly line. And so while China has a comparative advantage over anyone else in the textile industry because they can produce it for less, because they pay people less, doesn't make it a moral alternative. And I think that's the issue that really needs to be brought up, is whether the comparative advantage is really being treated morally, and what ways is it going, you know. If it's an issue of temperate zones, it's an issue of resource management, then I'm fully supportive of going with the most efficient. I mean, it's what makes the most sense, but
okay.
We're talking about people and lives and laws and governments that
thank you
are being used.
And we'll come back to that kind of thing.
Actually, just pursue that one step further, I guess, in terms of the moral issue, then there's the sustainability issue that you brought up in the very beginning. Is it really truly sustainable? And you know, in terms of looking at those goals and objectives you have on the board, that there's definitely a conflict.
Right. So one of the cons would be that the current system does not account for, literally, within the economic numbering system, account for the input of resources, how much that really costs, or the production of externalities, the production of the waste, so that the numbers that the GDP and so on reflect do not really reflect what I would say would be accurate pricing or costing of goods and services. So in that, so that's one of the reasons that bananas can be are cheap here, for example, is that transportation is subsidized, let's say, or the cost of gasoline and oil is subsidized, so that we don't pay the full cost of the global warming contributed in the transportation of bananas.
Well, another, I think, agricultural aspect of the furthering of a competitive, or what's it,
comparative
advantage things, would be the promotion of monocultures.
Promotion of monocultures.
Because if they can do that efficiently, then that means they can produce more of the same thing and export it cheaply. But that, again, may not be sustainable.
But a lot of countries have done this and to their own detriment, because they're shipping stuff out of the country that they could be using to feed their own people.
Right. And certainly we're seeing, for example, Vandana Shiva from India talks about her country producing cucumbers to the exclusion of the rice they need, let's say, because they have a comparative advantage in cucumbers. And so the world over now, there is certainly pressure for, especially for poor countries, to convert sustainable farming, sustainably farmed lands into crops for exports in order to serve their debt. So there's all these layers underneath the assumptions that our current economy runs under. And people of faith, I think, need to ask questions about that. And so we've just talked about some of the pros and cons, that there are some goods and some bads within the current system. And I want to move on to this way of giving a bit of a historical background for where we are today, the rubric that I found helpful. And this is from John Cobb, who's a theologian, but also the last 30 years of his career spent studying ecology and economics to see how they were connected and how a Christian might be called to respond, in his viewpoint anyway. And so he was asking the question, you know, in throughout history, what is it that people have given their allegiance to within a culture? So within Western culture, what is it that we have given our allegiance to? What has been, in a sense, our cultural idol? And he suggests that that first it was Christianism, at least in the West, in the Roman, after the Roman conquest and in the Middle Ages, that it was not God or Christ or a relationship with God, or what we might think of as a depth of faith, but sort of the institution of Christianity, that people were willing to give their lives for the institution that they believed in. And eventually you have the Crusades, and you have Protestants eventually fighting Catholics, and you have people dying for their Christianism. He points to there being a break or a significant change in that in that direction with the rise of nationalism. And apparently at the Treaty of Westphalia around 1650, nation states got together and said, you know, this business of killing each other over, you know, Protestants versus Catholics and so on needs to stop. So let's let the prince or the ruler of these nation states decide which will be their faith. So you had various nation states beginning to rise in power. And Cobb was careful to say, of course, that Christianism didn't die at that Treaty of Westphalia, and there's still Christianism amongst us. There's still nationalism amongst us. But the nationalism began to have, you know, people were willing to die for their nation state. That was the sort of the cultural idol, he would suggest. Until, what, maybe World War II is the sort of supreme, as nationalism being expressed in its extreme, that the world went to war over the right of a nation state to conquer territory and so on. And then it's interesting to note that at the end of World War II, the conquerors, the victors of World War II, got together partly to decide, you know, how can we prevent nation states from becoming so powerful again that we have that kind of war again. And they created many institutions like the, you know, the WTO and so on. I mean, UN and GATT and so on. That many of the goals of those organizations had to do with economic interdependencies. So that Cobb suggests that then, since World War II, economism became our culture's. We gave our allegiance to economism, to the growth of the economy, and to economic interdependencies. And then he suggests that in 1972, with the first Earth Day, that there began to be a few people willing to say that the growth of the economy is not the end-all and be-all of our lives, and that there might, that the health of the Earth and passing on a healthy Earth to our children is what we want to be about. 1972 is a handy time to suggest that started with the first Earth Day. And certainly, as we all know, economism is still a very powerful force in our world today. But there are, if you look at certain institutions, certain professors and students in colleges and so on, they don't see their primary role as creating good workers to get good jobs under sort of the idol of economism. They see their role as training students and being people that will teach about and live more sustainably on the earth, that the earth might be a healthy place for their children and others to enjoy into the distant future. Cobb would suggest that from a deeply Christian point of view, that none of these would be idols we would want to give our allegiance to, finally, but that and for all practical purposes, that we ought to throw our weight behind the earthists, because they are the ones, if you're caring for earth, you are caring for people. There is not a separation between the two. That environmental and social justice issues become wedded in that sort of caring. He gives the example of, you know, if there were beings, and what about the rest of the universe, that there's a God beyond creation itself in the Christian worldview, so that we cannot say we worship the earth, obviously. We continue to have a God that is transcendent as well as immanent, but that on sort of practical everyday purposes, we ought to throw our weight behind the activities of the earthists. So, any comments on that framework, and does it make sense?
Yeah, well, you said people who care about the earth, I don't know how you put it, but automatically care about other people, and I challenge that. To me, these are all beliefs, and there are people that are very pro-earth, but they don't have their heart open to other people who aren't pro-earth. And for what you have on there, everything is God, so it's wrong to degrade anything.
You're right.
These are all beliefs, and it's still a dualism. That Christians and another religion, got this nation and another religion. We got people who are for the earth, and then some people who just don't have their heart open enough or aren't conscious enough. So there's still a division. To me, we need loveism, just to have an open heart for everything. And then I still see a division with that. I mean, that's ideal, but that
right.
There's still a division.
Yeah, that's good. I'm not suggesting that all earthists, so to speak, are people who care for. I mean, there are some people who seem to be rabidly earthist, and therefore often neglect the needs of the poor, let's say. The environmental community has often been somewhat castigated, and sometimes rightly so, for caring for whales, let's say, more than people. And in some ways, the church in the last 10 years has rightly or so has said, you know, or last 30 years maybe, you know, that we are part of Earth, and that seeing them as separate is not right, is not the whole way to approach the problems. So I'm not saying that all Earthists are Right. I'm saying Cobb in general, and I would agree with him and say that our weight as Christians, in a practical everyday point of view, ought to go behind the efforts of earthists. And I'm defining earthists ideally as people who see the connections between environmental and social justice.
We still got those, that man over in Africa whose family needs to eat. And it's ideal, yeah, let's take care of the earth. But in the meantime, you know, and I know it's, this is, you're aware of that.
Yeah.
I guess we just gotta, again, keep our heart open to everybody and love everything. To me, that is it's almost all the same things. And I love the earth, but we just gotta include.
Well, maybe they're all the same in that they're incomplete. I mean, an idol is something that once you reach your idol or you have in hand, it doesn't offer all that it doesn't offer all that it promises. It doesn't give you all that it promises. These are all idols in a sense.
Okay.
So they share that in common. They do not share the object of their worship, however.
Okay.
Any other?
Yeah, I guess in terms of the just looking at the big picture, I guess, pardon using the overused term of holistic, but really it's what we're trying to do is look at the whole system and trying to stand back and look at the complete balance of the system. And this post-World War II economism that you mentioned is really, if you look at it, it's multinational corporations now that are basically taking over the system. And that's not sustainable. I think it's our responsibility as the human race to look at each other. This is what you're saying, I think, is look at, to make sure that we're cognizant of the entire system and do whatever we can to be truly altruistic as much as we can. And altruism would mean then every time we're looking at making a decision of consuming something or anything that we're doing to consume energy from the system, it's at a cost. And we need to be cognizant of that. And that, to me, is the only hope in the future, that we would hopefully, with as limited resources we have, we could hopefully we could spread it out to that person in Africa, or, you know, that we have, hopefully we can share it, and we'd make it all work.
Go ahead. What we're facing, too, I think, is a limit to the world resources being consumed by an ever-increasing population. And there's going to be a limit to it someplace where people are just not going to have enough to get around, and the people who are in a position to be in power are going to make sure that they get their part, and the people who are lower down on the scale are just going to have to do without.
Well, that's... you're pointing to a catastrophe.
I'm getting it.
In a way. I mean, and Cobb says, you know, Christianism ended with, or started to end with catastrophe of all these wars. Nationalism ended with a catastrophe of these horrific wars. Economism, we might suggest, has already wreaked havoc on the poor and on the earth, on the voiceless, in a sense. That's kind of often news to people in this culture, anyway, in America, because we're so wealthy comparatively that it seems like the economic system is, I mean, sure, there are a few problems here and there, but to those for whom the current economic system does not work, which is a majority of the world's population, perhaps it already is a catastrophe, and that's one of the reasons it needs to end, and that it's in these throes of, I mean, is Enron, are our corporate scandals lately, are they throes of economism? Is Bush's war on Iraq, is that a throw of, are we in the throes of, my God, maybe something is going to shift, and we're terribly scared of letting go of that current system? Because it already is a catastrophe for many people, and it's certainly a catastrophe for the species going extinct today. I said the other day that there are certainly throughout time, species go extinct. But right now, that rate is 1,000 times the background rate. And the reasons for that are human caused, habitat destruction being the primary source of the destruction of species and the loss of biodiversity. So, and the majority of this havoc is being caused by people who don't really get up in the morning and say, I think I want to make a species go extinct today, or, you know, I want to get 60 times richer today than my line workers, or, you know, but there is a system that is set up that is allowing that to happen. And after your comment in the back there, we'll move on to talk a little bit more about that system and how it might be changing already a little bit for the better. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, this is just a little thing, but we're often referring to other countries as where the poor really feel the economic system.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's definitely felt in the U.S. too, by the poor.
Thank you, yeah. And there are 30 million people in America who are hungry,
mm-hmm.
for example. There are about 850 million people around the world that are hungry. 30 million right here in our own country. So that's a long-term sort of perhaps way to categorize where it is our energies have gone as a culture. But since World War II, World War II is when GATT was created, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. And it's interesting to look at the history of GATT. Some of the initial battles around GATT that happened in the U.S. Senate, for example, were defeated because U.S. senators said, you know, this agreement takes away our national sovereignty. So you see nationalism kind of, you know, the fears around our own nationalism being usurped in order for economism to become more powerful. There were some throes of nationalism right within the U.S. Senate saying, we don't want to sign off on this part of GATT because it gives away our national sovereignty. And now, when we look at where we've progressed to in GATT and WTO, it's interesting how much of that national sovereignty we've been willing to sign away now in order for economism to continue, for the economic system to continue to grow. But a big shift occurred in the last 15 years in how the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, was written, in that they began to speak about non-tariff barriers to trade. For example, an environmental regulation could perhaps be seen as a barrier to trade. For example, shrimp raised in the mangrove swamps in Thailand. If the U.S. said to Thailand, we won't purchase those shrimp because it's destroying your mangrove swamps, your tidal areas, which indeed it is, Thailand, under the new regulations of the GATT, these are non-tariff barriers to trade again, could say to the GATT, well, look, the U.S. is not buying our shrimp, but we are challenging that as a non-tariff barrier to trade. The concern being, part of it is what you were mentioning back there, I'm not sure your name is with a hand up, but environmental and labor regulations can be seen as barriers to trade and challenged under what GATT became. In 1995, the GATT became the WTO, the World Trade Organization. And that, as you know, is what people were marching the streets about in 1999. Now, the specifics of what the WTO allows other countries to challenge other countries on are very complicated, of course. And there are a variety of stories of what we might say are nightmares, at least from an environmental labor perspective, and others that would argue that, well, at least the Clinton administration was pushing to get labor and environmental regulations separated from the WTO and how it was enforced, or at least labor and environmental regulations added on to the WTO. And I recently read in there's the UN summit in Johannesburg recently on sustainable development. I read a teeny paragraph in a newspaper article that said something about that one of the results of that meeting was that the WTO would not be able to challenge environmental regulations as part of its barriers to trade. And that's all it said. I was like, what else? You know, really? Because that would be pretty good news and a real step forward for protection of the environment, at least. I don't know what labor was able to get. This wasn't really a labor summit, so maybe it wasn't really talked about there. But this is all very much a part of the dynamic dialogue around how the WTO is enforced. The purpose of the WTO is to help trade happen, essentially, the World Trade Organization. So it's already kind of stacked against those who represent labor or the natural world, the environmental organizations. But it was interesting to see that one paragraph, and I don't know anything more now about if that's indeed the case. The worry is that the country with the lowest environmental regulations, the lowest labor regulations, will be the country that sets the standards. There will be sort of a lowest common denominator set, because the U.S., with its higher labor standards and higher environmental regulations, would not be able to compete against a country with very little regulation, because a corporation can operate there so much more cheaply. So this paragraph in that article is very encouraging to me, but I'm sorry I don't have more to say about that. So Paul, go ahead.
Didn't the United States challenge, or use the WTO to challenge some of the European nations about their resistance to our selling genetically modified foods over there?
Yes, I believe. Does anyone know for sure how that story ended?
Yeah, they did challenge it.
Yeah, the European Union does not want to import.
I don't know what happened.
Yeah, they don't want to import the GM, genetically modified foods.
Yeah, I don't know if it was a genuine objection or if there was something behind it that you didn't see.
There's a threat of fine, and I think it's in today's paper. Yeah. A significant
threat. Really? There is what, and then what if the EU was found guilty, so to speak, then we would be able to slap a lot of tariffs on their goods. Would be one way we would get back at them. So there's a structure for.
Well, I don't think that's it. I think it's that we're.
That's one way.
We're probably the best agricultural nature in the world, and we're trying to sell our apples, and, for example, in our area, to everybody we can, and genetically modified grains and so forth. If they're objecting to them, they're objecting to them because they don't want us competing with them.
Well, but there are.
Or maybe they don't want genetically modified food.
There are a lot of people. A lot of people in Europe are concerned about potential environmental and health problems with genetically modified food. So it's more than that, and it's also, well, a lot of debatable assumptions behind our being the best agricultural country in the world. Certainly, we're maybe the most productive, but what's that based on? But petroleum inputs, and that's certainly not, and topsoil loss and so on. So there are a lot of costs to that agricultural system as well. But Paul, there are certainly that's certainly one of the current hot ones in the WTO, but I don't know where it's ended up and what the fine would be is going to be if they win. But it's interesting that it's been one way for the European Union to protect itself against what it sees as something potentially damaging. Anyone hasn't said anything yet? I'll come back to you in a minute as we move along here. No? Okay, go ahead.
One thing I just want to hit is that when the WTO is making these decisions about what countries can do in deciding what is a barrier to trade. These aren't elected or democratic officials that are making these decisions. These are actually business executives or industry insiders or whatever other PC term it is for them now. They meet in secret. No one gets to find out who they are, what their names are, what their association is. And they meet in secret, and they anonymously hand down the verdict. And the governments have to agree to this by these unelected officials, but nobody outside of WTO gets to pick or find out who they are.
And yeah, that's one of the big cons to the current system, is that it's non-democratic.
And it's coming down, and the democratically passed laws are being by America laws. I don't know if you know familiar with these, but we say that our tax dollars, that the government, when the government buys stuff, that they're going to have to use, since they're using our tax dollars, they have to hire American workers. They have to try and use American steel whenever possible. These were passed years ago as a way to try and boost the U.S. economy with our own tax dollars, try and keep the money, you know, locally, try and support local workers. And what has happened now is those laws are all kaput. And I'm from Tacoma, and that's really becoming a big issue because it was familiar with the Narrows Bridge Project. They're planning on building a new Narrows Bridge, and they had planned to use well-paid union laborers, local laborers, and use U.S. steel. And two Japanese companies are saying foul and are going to sue Tacoma under the WTO. And it doesn't look good for Tacoma. It looks like we're going to use Japanese steel and Japanese labor and be forced to spend millions and millions of our tax dollars on a bridge that we need, but we're sending the money outside of our local economy. The only reason the budget got passed by local taxpayers was under the promise that the money would be redistributed locally.
Thanks, that's a great example. And you, yeah, I mean, that's one of the biggest concerns of WTO, of those who protest against WTO, is that it's non-democratic, and you said it very well, that regulations that we have passed, for example, something under the Clean Water Act or the Clean Air Act, and there have been examples of, for example, Venezuelan gasoline was not clean enough, did not meet our standards under the Clean Air Act. Venezuela challenged that, saying that's a non-tariff barrier to trade. And we essentially are forced to be open to purchasing Venezuelan gas because it's a non-tariff barrier to trade. That environmental regulation is. So you can see it, and the example you gave is of the WTO actually impacting a local city, a city's jurisdiction about how it can carry out a project. So it's potentially a very insidious way for local government to be challenged. So that's one of my main concerns too about how the WTO carries out its business. Go ahead back there.
Urbanism is also, I think, dramatically affected the individual's ability to exercise his rights over his own property.
Okay.
And so, if you want another example,
You're saying earthists are doing.
Well, I think.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm not sure I fully, you know, understand all the definitions there.
Yeah.
It is the earthism movement that I think is behind a lot of the environmental mandates that have come down and determined what people can do on their property.
So, do you have an example personally?
Oh, for example, people who own waterfront.
People who own waterfront, huh?
Or who have water running through their property. Many, and I'm from Tacoma also, have spent years investing in real estate with the hope that when they retire, they'd be able to develop, say, a 10-acre tract of land. And then in the 90s, when the Growth Management Act was passed, it dramatically changed where this kind of development could and could not take place. So a particular person I know was not able to develop this 10-acre tract because it was outside the area that was determined for urban.
There are examples of individuals being affected by environmental regulation. I suppose I could come back and say, well, the Growth Management Act, right? Is that what was passed democratically by a majority of the community saying this is what we want our place to be like. We don't want, for some reason environmentally perhaps, that land is too sensitive to develop. And we found that out now, and so we need to regulate ourselves so that that place is not destroyed. And maybe it's for the long-term good of the community.
Passed by the Washington legislature.
Okay, and we could also say, well, ultimately nothing is really ours. We are, the earth is the Lord's. And can we hold those things lightly and accept limitations on our own, what we might think of as our right, in order for the common good to be protected? I mean, it's very personal and a challenging situation, and they're happening all over, but I think it's pretty clear that that our imprint is already larger than the natural world can sustain. Like the gentleman over there was talking about population exceeding the capacity of the land to support everybody. So I'm of the opinion we need to err on the side of strong environmental regulations because of those things. Now, I'm sure everyone doesn't agree on that, but in this room or obviously elsewhere. But
that brings to the point, you know, you just got another ism on your chart, earthism.
Yeah.
And your proposition was, why shouldn't we throw our weight behind the earthism people? Whoever made that point. That can be interpreted in many ways, and it's these isms, as they come up, always start out with some idealists who have some view of the world the way they think it should be, and they promulgate that. And this then gets bought by a number of people who have some other interests, and they gradually assume the power in these isms. And ultimately, if you see what happened, all you have to do is look at history, and you see these things ultimately end up in conflicts. And mostly, they end up in wars, because there are people on all different sides of these isms. Mm-hmm. So you turn this thing over to the earthists, just down the road, you're looking at another set of worldwide conflicts, because there are many people who do not buy into what you have just said today. And I think everything that you have said is arguable.
Okay.
There are other positions.
That's true. I'm coming at it from
like for the earthism. What you have to recognize is there will be a lot of people who will fight against you.
Well, I'm also not saying we should. Earthism is a false idol.
Well, it is a false idol.
And so a Christian critique would say, no, we are not earthists. We are Christians, and as Christians, let us agree that the earth is the Lord's, that it is a place that is sacred, that to degrade it is wrong. That our economy ought to be set up to to increase the health and well-being of communities, not degrade communities. And our current economy is set up so that it degrades communities, human and non-human. It's a violent economy.
I would reject that hypothesis. I don't think you can demonstrate it. I think it's completely arbitrary.
Okay. Well, it's good to have people of different opinions here, because that's where. And why don't we talk then about? I don't know where to go from there.
Well, it's your program. You can go wherever you want with it.
No,
but there's a lot of people who will take issues 360, just like this fire ring here, on the subject of Earthism.
I've already acknowledged that Earthism is not where I'm suggesting we need to put our weight. I'm suggesting that because Earthism is, you're right, can become an idolatry, can become an idol for any of us. What I'm saying is that as Christians, it doesn't seem arguable to me that these are things that we ought to agree on. And if we can agree on these, then the economy that we would set up ought to obey these sort of ideas. And I don't think the current economy comes close to doing that. Because people in places around the world are being degraded as a result of how the current economy is set up.
I don't think it's the economy. To me, these are all symptoms. And then the cause, if you look right to the center, is that people don't know who they are. And we're children of God, creates so that through us could be manifested all that is true and good and holy. And we're not to forget that. And we focus on Earth, but until people know who they are and make choices based on love, that list can keep going longer and longer, and we'll keep having those wars and wars until people make choices based on love.
Thank you. And I started this week with talking about spirituality, with the spirituality that addresses who it is that we are. using some of Dale's work, that Dale's been talking about this week as well, I think fundamentally it is a spiritual question. That's why we can't leave these discussions only to the economists, for example. I mean, some economists are also people of faith and spiritual, and so they can help us even more. But I don't want to leave it only to the economists. And you've had your hand up for a long time. And we only have about 5-10 more minutes, and I need to go on time because I'm involved with the service tonight. So
I just wanted to go back to some of the topic issues that maybe you were talking about. Mm-hmm. I think that everybody in any community anywhere should be very aware of that natural resources anywhere can only go so far, and they can only sustain so many people in any given area. And I think that we all need to be responsible and aware of that. And we are very fortunate in this country and in the Western world at large to have the rights to be able to do that. And as John said earlier, there are many, many millions of people around the world who are not allowed to have a voice. And their lands are stripped and detrimental so that they can't grow food to sustain their families. And I just think that we need to be very aware of the limits of our resources, and they can't be stretched and stretched beyond, otherwise we'll end up in the same situation as some of the less fortunate countries. Just need to be aware of the limits on resources, natural resources.
With nationalism, there were recognizable boundaries, and there was military power to protect the will of that particular entity. What we're seeing today is a national corporation that knows no boundaries, can move into all levels of any country, and is supporting its will by supporting the power of the United States. That as the superpower, we are backing the corporations and giving them the opportunity. And they are extending incredible power throughout all nations, with their ability to go in and with just wealth and magnitude. We already see it in this country where they put the squeeze on states. They tell states, either you play ball with us, either you give us concessions, let us do this and this and this, or we'll go someplace else, and you won't have the jobs, you won't have the economy. And they're doing it to other nations. They put the squeeze on them. And an example for me was in Buenos Aires, McDonald's signs attached to the street signs all throughout the town. It was like, how did they get inside the government and get that kind of central advantage? So yeah, that to me is a threat. And what the answer to that is, I'm not sure, because it is a very powerful threat.
It is. And when we talk about free trade, it's really impossible to talk about free trade when 51 of the world's most powerful economies are corporations. 51 of the 100 wealthiest entities in the world are corporations. So when a corporation that wealthy, and a corporation is not really a free market, it does what it wants with its money in certain ways. It's not open to the market as markets are defined and as a government would hope for when it says free markets. So when these powerful corporations go in, most of the countries they deal with are not as wealthy as they are. And I happen to agree that generally our government makes it safe for corporations to roam the earth to find the places where it's cheapest to work. And what it seems to me happens, if you look at what happens, is that yes, jobs are created, and some people now have a job that didn't have a job before. However, there is no loyalty to the well-being of that community in the long run. That corporation will just as easily move from that place to another place once labor gets more expensive or it's cheaper somewhere else, or the environmental base is degraded such that they can't operate there anymore. So again, it seems almost like the consumption of goods and services, the growth of the economy, becomes more important than the well-being of community and the human and non-human community that where the corporation resides. So an answer would be for us to create the political will to change the corporate structure and support a government that would support changing the corporate structure so that the well-being of communities would be maintained, not the well-being of a few, relative few, who are getting incredibly rich. Since 1960, in 1960, the wealth, the income of the top 20% of the world's people was 30-1 compared to the income of the lowest 20% of the world's people. It's now 84-1. In 1990, it was 60-1. 1995, the most recent data I've seen, it was 84-1. It's not right. It's not right for that to happen. And briefly, you have exciting stories of options that you know of. Let's end with a few positive stories. I think it's really important for us to know what are the weaknesses, what are the downsides of the current system, because what's told us by our media and by our government is a very different story. If the gross domestic product is up in our culture, in our society, that's good news, and politicians get reelected. The gross domestic product is just a measure of the goods and services that flow through our hands. It's a measure of money, exchange of money. It does nothing, it does not have value, a way to account for values that we would all agree on. There's a group in California, as one of the positive stories, Redefining Progress in California, is developing an alternative way to measure economic growth. And what they're saying is, when you have an Exxon Valdez oil spill, which is a very common example given, you don't think an Exxon Valdez oil spill is a good thing, right? Most people would agree that generally we don't want a lot of oil spills. But it increases the GDP because you have to go up there and clean it up. When you install scrubbers on coal plants, that increases GDP. When you have social breakdown, divorces, increases GDP. So the GPI, the folks doing the GPI, the genuine progress indicator, are subtracting those costs and adding in things we would agree are of value. Volunteer work, work in the home. They're adding the value of those things, and they're subtracting the ecological and social costs that I think as a society we would agree are costs. And they're fine. If you want to look on the website, look up redefiningprogress.org. The GPI has gone down 42% since 1972. We all know the GDP has gone up. So, what about creating the political will to change how we measure economic growth? That would be an exciting story. We'd read in the paper, the GPI went up this year. Great. We're going to keep those politicians in. But the GDP would become something we would look back on and say, that was kind of weird. That was just a measure of the flow of money through our system. It didn't have any attachments to what we would really value. Any other exciting stories?
Excuse me, some exciting developments in terms of local currency being developed around the globe.
Can you give an example of how local currencies are working?
Yeah, there's definitely some examples of where communities have developed their own currency to exchange goods and services within the local economy. That has been outside of the dollar. And it allows a form of barter trade, I guess, would be the way to look at it. It allows then people to exchange goods and services without actually using that.
And it keeps wealth within a community.
Right, instead of having income on its own.
And so you can support local people more easily and also across disciplines, so to speak, or across areas of service with those dollars. So, and communities indeed print up Cascadia dollars, or Ithaca, New York's one that has a good example of that. Co-op America is a good organization to know about. Co-op America, they put out a quarterly, but also have a really helpful website on these sorts of issues, on how it is we could support an economy that values community.
Actually, I'd just like to add, in terms of the Co-op America, they're affiliated with Yes Magazine over in Cambridge, Ireland. They have this issue is about economic.
Yeah, Yes Magazine, and the subtitle is A Journal of Positive Futures. So it's a neat magazine. It's not one that's talking about only what's wrong, but they're primarily focused on positive futures. And so they have, and the current one is on local economy, I believe. So it has these kind of stories about groups saying, well, we can do it differently, and we will choose to create an economy that allows people, that supports people in place, this place where we live. And if people do that the world over, gradually we'll move toward having a system that I think values the rights of community and the ability to support those communities, human and non-human.
That's what I was just going to comment too on your on sustaining the communities. If we were to put some of the wealth that we do have into helping these third world countries or countries that have to have multiple children for any of them to survive, we wouldn't have to sustain such a huge population because we'd level off a little bit and have use the resources that we do have, but we wouldn't. It would just, I think it's just overcoming the resources by just the population growth.
Can you say the first part of your...
Well, if we as a nation, being wealthy as we are, were to put some, and I think we do help other countries, but if we were to help them just learn how to manage themselves better, then they would be able to sustain the population that they have, rather than just this over-increasing population that just then requires more because it just doesn't stop, and eventually it can only sustain so much. So if we could slow down the population growth a little bit, maybe we could use what we have to keep who we have already sustained, but not have such an accelerated growth.
You bring up an interesting point, and that is that foreign aid is certainly one way we can offer assistance to other countries. And most people think the United States gives a lot away. In fact, the United States gives, of the 22 richest countries in the world, we give, what, number 22? The 22 wealthiest countries in the world, we give, as a percent of our wealth, we give the lowest amount.
1/10 of 1%.
I think it's 1/10 of 1% of our GNP goes toward foreign aid. Whereas, and you look at Norway, Finland, Sweden, those...
And most of that foreign aid goes to Israel and Egypt.
And most, a good percentage of it goes to Israel and Egypt. And it gets to the point where you can argue ethics of family planning, but we won't do that. But currently, the Bush administration is not releasing $34 million, I believe it is, to the UN for family planning. Nothing to do with abortions. That's not the issue here. It's simply the money would go to help educate women. And if you look at what is most effective in decreasing unwanted pregnancies, it's education and opportunities for women. And that's what this money goes for. It doesn't go toward supporting abortions. And yet, because of the appearance of that, and because of the political powers that be in this country that support Bush, that's not being released. So that's a good example of one way we might become a more compassionate country, would be to be willing to give more of our money to worthy programs around the world to address those kind of needs. And we'll have one more comment and we'll close, because it's time to go. Vespers.
My comment is that, I've been involved in ecology and environment for 40-some years, and control of our environment in this world goes down to one major problem, and that's politics. You look at the federal government, look at the budget, how much money is going to where, and how it's going. It's scary that this kind of involvement exists, and I say it exists primarily because people do not get out and vote. They stand out and talk and talk and talk, but when it comes out and to vote for people that are concerned about this world, they don't get out and vote. So how can you... I think this is an important area, is that you've got to get the public to be aware of what's going on. Because as long as we've got, 500 and some idiots back in Washington, D.C. running this country, you're going to have problems with the environment. Period.
Well, thank you for that. Let's close with prayer. Let's close with prayer. This is too wild to not close with prayer.